This is Jeff Spittler, Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 44, November 4th, 2001. Okay, I'd like to try something different this morning. Now for something completely different. And this will sort of be a transition between the review that we just did and then the new material coming up. And I'd want to do this by trying to provide a biography of at least one influential Scot whose life spanned the period of the, shall we say, British Civil Wars, before and after. And that's Samuel Rutherford. And in order to do that, as you'll see, we'll have to spend a little bit of time on another minister named David Calderwood. And if this works out, we'll see. We might cover some other people after this. And much of the material I'm covering today comes from a recent biography by Dr. John Coffey called Politics, Religion, and the British Revolutions, The Mind of Samuel Rutherford. Interestingly enough, and I forgot to bring it, there's a review in this month's Covenant or Witness of this book. I don't know if anybody's seen that. And it's a very positive review, which generally, I mean, I concur with, but there's, the review is quite positive. In many respects, it's deserved. Dr. Coffey is very perceptive in demonstrating Rutherford's diverse legacy. And by that, I mean, you'll see that sort of different people or different traditions have appropriated him. And I think he's very accurate in that standpoint. And the book's it's very readable. I think he tries to be very fair. You could say that the review in the Covenant or Witness says that Coffey's sympathetic to Rutherford. I guess I would say he's probably as sympathetic to Rutherford as his theology allows. Okay, so he's not really sympathetic to the Presbyterian ideals or anything like that, but I think he does try to give him a fair treatment. There's a few places where I would take issue, not necessarily a serious issue, but just as long as you understand where it comes from. And with that understanding, I think it's a very good book. So, yes, it's published by Cambridge University Press. It's part of their series on early modern British history, and I'm not sure. I didn't check Amazon or anything recently. I got mine from, I forget where, somebody who ordered, I think, who ordered a bunch of, like a box or something, and had one left over. For some reason, Bruce and Alan, you know, had gotten these books, and, you know, they didn't bother mentioning to me. Then after the fact, of course, they say, you know, you're familiar with this, aren't you, Dave? Okay. Coffey, often, you know, you often hear him in here refer to Rutherford as a persecutor because he thought that sex, S-E-C-T-S, should be suppressed. And he doesn't, you know, it doesn't fit our sort of modern ideal of, you know, tolerance and so on. So, but in any case, it's a good book, well worth reading. Okay, Rutherford was born around 1600. He was raised in southeast Scotland, almost certainly in the town of Nisbet in the parish of Crailing, which is near Jedburgh. And Jedburgh, thank you. Thank you. I was going to say, you know, I will say Edinburgh the whole time, or try to, not Edinburgh. But yes, Jedburgh, thank you. Now, does it make a difference where he was born? Yes. I mean, the minister in Crailing from 1604 onward was David Calderwood. So I want to spend a little bit of time on Calderwood to try to understand how he may have been an influence on Rutherford. Calderwood's probably best known for writing what was published eventually as an 8-volume history of the Church of Scotland. Apparently there's 3 or 4 versions of what Calderwood wrote, of which the 8-volume history is not the longest. Calderwood was one of the ministers that resisted James's machinations to control the church. 1608, he was punished. He got confinement to his parish, and he was disbarred from all ecclesiastical assemblies for opposing the substitution of James's handpick representatives for the duly elected representatives to the General Assembly. So you'll recall that James had been trying to handpick the representatives, and he protested against this, and as a result was punished. When James visited Scotland in 1617, Calderwood helped to prepare a protest with 53 other ministers against James's proposal that he and his committee of bishops could make church law. Calderwood had to appear before James and refute him from his knees. Well, I thought I might read a little bit of this interaction, but I guess I left the book that it was in at home, so I guess I won't read it. James deprived him of his ministry, and while there were various pseudo-judicial proceedings going on, Calderwood had a nobleman that was trying to intercede for him, and because of that, his judgment got delayed. But under one discussed punishment, Calder would have been penalized with transportation to Virginia. But while this was going on, he slipped away to the Netherlands. He wasn't actually banished to the Netherlands. He just sort of self-banished himself. In the Netherlands, he published a book called The Altar of Damascus, the title referring to the foreign altar that King Ahaz copied for the temple. And when James died in 1625, Calderwood came back, apparently living, I'll say, quietly in Edinburgh, or maybe we could say, anachronistic as it may be, under the authorities' radar screen, where he, quote, strengthened the hand of nonconformists. And according to Howey, and this is from this book, The Scots Worthies, which is a collection of short biographies of various Covenanters. He contributed very much to the covenanted work carried on in that period. For first, he had an active hand in drawing up several excellent papers, wherein were contained the records of church policy betwixt the year 1576 and 1596, which were presented and read by Mr. Johnston, the clerk at the General Assembly in Glasgow. You may recall that at this General Assembly in Glasgow, that was the first one after the National Covenant, maybe the second one, but was important. General Assembly, there was a lot of debate over who would be the clerk, because one clerk had the minutes from the recent years, and the other clerk, Archibald Johnston, had the minutes from the earlier years with more desirable precedents. And it would appear that David Calderwood aided and abetted in this effort. So it was an effort over a period of time. Also during this time, he wrote much of his history of the Church of Scotland. And after the upheaval of 1638, Calderwood became a minister again, this time in, Simon, correct my pronunciation on this, if you will, Pencaitland. It's just spelled just like I said it, Pencaitland.
Where's that?
Well, in Scotland. Right there. Oh well. Okay. Let the record show. I might be right. Okay. Later, he was tasked by the General Assembly to perform some other committee business, such as drawing up the form of the Directory for Public Worship. And he died in 1650 or 1651, according to the two sources I looked at, about age 75. So this was early on. Rutherford was exposed. You know, this was his minister. Okay, and this would have been somewhat unusual at the time. Let's see, quoting from Coffee again, at a time when most Scots listened to preachers unwilling to attack the king's ecclesiastical policies, Rutherford had the rare experience of hearing a true exponent of the Melvillian theory of the two kingdoms, asserting the independence of the church from the crown and the need to eschew all popish ceremonies. The experience marked him for life, for he was to be a Melvillian in the mold of Calderwood. So, Rutherford pretty clearly was influenced strongly by this, you know, having this guy as his minister. And later they would have been in Edinburgh, their time in Edinburgh would have overlapped some. Seems likely that Rutherford may have been introduced to some of the quote radicals in Edinburgh by Calderwood. In 1617, Rutherford was admitted into Edinburgh University. There were only 6 academic staff, surprisingly. Several of the professors were later to be leading covenanters, at least, say, moderate covenanters. Andrew Ramsey was his professor of divinity from 1620. He was a minister in the church, so to some degree went along with the episcopal trends, but refused to read Laud's liturgy in 1637 and played an important role with the Glasgow Assembly in 1638 and was a moderator of the 1640 General Assembly. Later, he did refuse to preach against the engagement. He was disciplined for that. So that would be sort of a moderate position to not, then to, you know, not preach against the engagement. A little bit about the environment in Edinburgh, again from Coffee. Rutherford found the real radicals outside the university in the private meetings or conventicles being organized in Edinburgh by a group of Presbyterian merchants led by John Mine and William Rigg. Many connections between these men and Rutherford in later years suggest that he had known them as a student. Rutherford wrote letters both to Mine and Rigg and also to Mine's wife, Barbara Hamilton, who was responsible for sparking off one of the 1637 Edinburgh prayer book riots, and to his son John, who succeeded Rutherford as minister of Anwath. This thing about Barbara Hamilton, there's different theories about who started, who threw the stool at the at the lug. One theory is that it was this Barbara Hamilton. So let's see, I want to read a little bit more from this. Let's see. Barbara Hamilton's niece was to marry John Livingston, and her sister married Robert Blair. Both men were close friends of Rutherford, members of the Radical Party in the Kirk. It is even possible that the Euphame Hamilton, whom Rutherford married, was related to Barbara Hamilton. Even if that was not so, this Radical Party was still a remarkably close and coherent group, motivated by a clear and fervent vision of ecclesiastical renewal. It is highly probable that Calderwood was in contact with the Edinburgh Radicals in 1617 and deliberately put them in touch with this promising young parishioner. In his History of the Church of Scotland, he describes in some detail the situation in Edinburgh when Rutherford was a student. He presents the ministers of Edinburgh as being at loggerheads with the magistrates, particularly the group of godly merchants led by Mine and Rigg. What drove them apart were the 5 articles passed by General Assembly at Perth in 1618, which ordered the observance of traditional holy days, confirmation of the laity by bishops, private baptism, and communion for the infirm, and most controversial of all, kneeling at communion. Radicals in Edinburgh regularly boycotted services held by their ministers on holy days, or communions which required communicants to kneel in accordance with the Articles of Perth. They provocatively opened their shops at the time of the services and tried to persuade others not to attend, arousing the fury of the ministers who attempted to have them banished. Censored books like Calderwood's attack on the Articles of Perth were circulating, and fierce arguments took place in town meetings between the ministers and the Presbyterians. Every communion was a dramatic event as people watched to see who would kneel when the sacrament was given. According to Calderwood, there were few who did. For a young student, the Presbyterian subculture, with its clandestine and subversive activities, held a powerful attraction, although as an older man he would have trouble understanding the attractiveness of the separatist subculture to London Puritans. Having come from the countryside, Rutherford must have felt the exhilaration of being plunged into the middle of an ideological debate of national significance. By 1620, however, it had become apparent that suffering as well as excitement was integral to the life of the godly. In April of that year, Mine, Rigg, and several others were hauled before the High Commission to answer for their nonconformity and charged to leave Edinburgh. Although eventually they were able to stay, the experience left its mark on Rutherford. When he himself was banished to Aberdeen in 1636, he wrote, "That honor that I have prayed for these 16 years, my kind Lord hath now bestowed on me, even to suffer for my royal and princely King Jesus, and for his kingly crown, and the freedom of his kingdom that his father hath given him." The example of Rigg and Mine had won a convert to the cause whose zeal would know no bounds. It was intensified when they were finally banished from Edinburgh by the Privy Council in 1624. In 1638, Rutherford wrote that his present spiritual ecstasies were something Christ hath been keeping these 14 years for me. If Calderwood was the first crucial influence on Rutherford, Rigg and Mine were the second. Okay. In 1622, Robert Boyne became principal of the university. Rutherford stayed on, so even though he started in 1617, he didn't graduate and leave. You know, one of these graduate students just stayed on. Boyd had been a professor of theology in France, then at Glasgow University. He opposed the Articles of Perth and supported private conventicles. James had Boyd deprived of his position and expelled from Edinburgh within a year, but let's see, again, quoting from Coffee, yet James had acted too late. Boyd had already made a significant impact on Rutherford and various other members of what was to become the Radical Party in the Kirk. David Dixon, John Livingston, and Robert Blair, who had been his students at Glasgow. Indeed, the royal treatment of Boyd probably gave these men the extra inspiration they needed to carry on their underground crusade on behalf of high Calvinist theology and a pure Presbyterian Scotland. The royal treatment here being a different from what we think of as royal treatment. This is the royal treatment, how you were treated by James rather than being treated like James. Rutherford was made a regent of humanity at the university in 1623, so he was teaching. In 1626, though, he was accused of falling into fornication with Euphame Hamilton. Okay. And I was really perplexed by this review, and if none of you have read it, maybe it won't make any sense to you, but he says something like, in the review of his Coffee book, he says that Rutherford committed fornication with Euphame Hamilton. Rutherford was disciplined for sin, repented, was converted, and began to study for the ministry. Now, if you read the book, you'll see that Coffee does think that Rutherford probably did commit fornication, but there's a number of points against it, which is how most of his biographers have treated it. I don't find Coffee's arguments particularly compelling, but some of the points, you know, I mean, some points definitely lean in that direction, and other points, you know, lean away from that. He did get married to this Euphame Hamilton. They did have a child. You know, the exact dates of the marriage and the child, I guess, would be what would settle the case, and in this case, are not actually known. You know, at this date, it's probably impossible to draw a sure conclusion about the incident. It is somewhat puzzling because he was accused of scandal, and that's quoted. And his previous biographers mostly explained this away by saying that he'd actually married without getting the proper kind of episcopal permission. And Coffey thinks that's, you know, it's unlikely that was really the scandal. There's a little bit of evidence that wasn't the scandal. I mean, there apparently was some committee and he was replaced. And later he did serve with some of these on a committee with some of the man who had accused him. That's sort of the things in favor of it. The things against it are that this was really not brought up very much, except for there's one time one of his critics said he'd been loose in his youth. Maybe that's what he was referring to. He maintained good relationships with all the other Presbyterians and so on. So it's a little hard to say. If you're, you know, again, I'd refer you to Coffee's book. He sort of lays it out. But what I was perplexed at in the review is he just says, okay, this happened, and then Rutherford was disciplined for sin, repented, was converted, and began to study for the ministry. And none of the other stuff actually appears in the book that he repented, was converted, or began to study for the ministry. Yeah. I mean, of course, if he was guilty, then presumably he probably did repent, but one presumes. But you know, other than that, it's a little hard to say. So I found the treatment in the Covenant or Witness review to be a bit over the top. What's that? No comment. Okay. Samuel Rutherford then became a minister in 1627. There's little known exactly about, you know, what brought him to the parish of Anwath. And Anwath is a, well, as best I could tell at the time, it was a small village. Today, it's not really anything there that I could see. Now, maybe it was hidden.
There's
a house across the road. That's all you can see there. Now, I don't know if you go on further up that road, what else is up there? Maybe that you come to a proper village. But I will say this: to get to Anwath, you have to go through this really small town called Gatehouse on Fleet or something like that. I was going to bring an atlas today and show you, but didn't. So, you know, even that's a small town today, so, and there aren't any other big towns around. So it was apparently a pretty rural village. It appears that he was brought there by Sir John Gordon, who was later the Viscount Kenmure. Gordon seems to be somewhat of a study in contrast. If you read this account of Gordon in Howie, which I later read was actually written by Rutherford, so I don't know. I mean, it doesn't say it's written by Rutherford in the Howie text, but you see, if you go towards the back, there's this lot of things where it says, the minister, you know, said such and such to Gordon, and he said such and such while Gordon's on his deathbed. And it reminds you of John, you know, the apostle whom Christ loved, but not actually naming himself, and that's sort of how it's written. So, anyways, according to this, Howie, which maybe is according to Rutherford, as Gordon came of age, he became somewhat irreligious and profane, which when he arrived at manhood broke out into more gross acts of wickedness. Yet all the while the Lord never left him altogether without a check or witness in his conscience. Yea, sometimes when at ordinances, particularly sacramental occasions, he would be filled with a sense of sin, which, being borne powerfully in upon his soul, he was scarcely able to hold out against. But for a long time he was a stranger to a true and saving conversion. He would have been about 28 when Samuel Rutherford came to Anwath. So, you know, if he was a irreligious and profane, but yet wanted particularly someone like Samuel Rutherford, which he apparently did, to come, I thought, you know, sort of interesting character. Let's see. Okay, Gordon married in the next year Jean Campbell, the sister of the Marquis of Argyll. She was a very godly woman. Many of the letters written by Rutherford in the collection of letters are written to her. 1633, Gordon slipped out of a parliament feigning illness rather than have to vote against the king in a church-state issue. And then the next year he did actually have an illness and died, and that gave him time to lay hold of his salvation. And on his deathbed, he charged the bishop not to enforce the king's edicts with regards to popish worship. So it's maybe a bit difficult to see Gordon as bringing Rutherford to Anwath to participate in some kind of radical Presbyterian conspiracy or something. But for some reason, apparently did want Rutherford to come. And Coffey suggests that Gordon had spent time in France with John Welsh, who was John Knox's son-in-law. You'll recall Knox remarried a very young woman when he was old, and their daughter, her name was Elizabeth, married this John Welsh. So we're now see, you know, a little tie all the way from the 1500s to, you know, from the first Reformation down. Yeah, and Welsh was in France because he had crossed James by preaching a fiery sermon right after the 17th of December 1596 uprising in Edinburgh. This is the one with the Octavian and cubicular court factions creating some uprising. He was then imprisoned in Blackness Castle and exiled along with Andrew Melville in 1606. So, I don't know, whatever the case, Rutherford was brought to Anwath. He was able to be ordained without taking Episcopalian charge. That was one of his biographers, McWard, said that he did it without giving an engagement to the bishop. The local bishop, Lamb, was apparently a moderate, and while this was unusual, some ministers were ordained in the Presbyterian fashion. Let's see, when Rutherford moved to Anwath at the same time, hey, Anwath is in southwest Scotland. The same time in southwest Scotland, these revivals were going on. So, that, like the Kirk of Shotts revival would have been to the north. Been north of Anwath. But, you know, like maybe, I'm going to guess 40 or 50 miles, not very far. let's see. When Rutherford got there, okay, he came to be the minister of a small rural parish. What did he do? This is from, again, from Coffee. The arrival of this young revivalist preacher in a country parish created some stir. Before he came, his parishioners wrote in 1639, "Our souls were under that miserable extreme famine of ye word, that we had only poor help of a sermon every second Sabbath by reason of a most inconvenient union with other two kirks." The quote's actually given in original spelling. But Rutherford changed the situation dramatically, for he was a whirlwind of enthusiasm. As another minister explained to Wadrow, he seemed to be always praying, always preaching, always visiting families, always visiting the sick, always catechizing, always teaching in the schools, always writing treatises, always reading and studying. "He used ordinarily to rise by 3 o'clock in the morning," wrote John Livingston, "and was the instrument of much good among a poor, ignorant people, many of which he brought to the knowledge and practice of religion." So he had a profound influence on his parish, and also continued, as you can see, with some concerns beyond just the parish itself. Right? His wife died in 1630, and all of their children apparently have preceded their mother in death. When he later writes, some of his letters are ones letters of comfort or and condolence to, like Lady Kemmerer, who lost her husband and then lost several children apparently, but she lost her son, who had been, before he came of age, would have been the second Viscount of Kemmerer. And his own experience seems to have helped them in writing these comforting letters. Okay, but about his maybe wider activities, and this will start to lead into a little bit of how Rutherford is viewed differently by different people, but traditionally Rutherford's biographers have romanticized his ministry at, quote, Leafy Anwath by the, quote, Fair Solway, treating it as a model for the evangelical pastor, ignoring how intensely political Rutherford's work was. In terms of population, Anwath was an obscure and minor parish, but as its parishioners were quick to point out, it had strategic importance. It was the parish of Rutherford's patron, Viscount Kenmure, the prime and most eminent man for power and commandment in these bounds, and it was situated on ye highway betwixt England and Ireland. Today it's a little bit, you know, a few miles off the highway, but it is on a, you know, it is close. Rutherford realized the strategic importance of his position and quickly began to establish connections with the various branches of the influential Gordon family and other local gentry. One of his closest friends was Jane Campbell, the wife of Viscount Kenmure and the sister of Lord Lorne, later the Earl of Argyll and the most powerful nobleman in Scotland. Rutherford was also in regular correspondence with Marian McNaught, a niece of Lord Lorne and the wife of the Provost of Kirkcudbright. That's spelled Kirkcudbright for those of you. What's that? Yeah, but it's spelled Kirkcudbright. Kirkcudbright. His assiduous cultivation of noble connections was part of a far-sighted campaign to promote the cause of Presbyterianism in the Southwest. Its success is demonstrated by the fact that 77 of Rutherford's correspondents signed the Kirkcudbright petition against the new prayer book in 1637. But Rutherford was sowing on fertile ground. The 1625 Act of Revocation had alienated the nobility from the king by threatening to return the land they had gained at the Reformation of the Church. Moreover, the southwest of Scotland had traditionally been a radical stronghold, responsive to the message of the Lollards and the Reformers. By the way, I brought a couple photographs of the church in Anwath today. So this is the front of the church. It was built according to the inscription in 1627, and this is a view from the front, and this is a view from inside. And inside, there's a number of graves and monuments. And while I was there, there was a family there, and it turned out the man was a minister in the Church of Scotland. But he said, in the Western Isles, where I forget how he put it, where Reformed theology is still strong, that's what he said. And he said that all these monuments would be anathema to the Reformers, you know, that they're all put in there later. And so it was kind of interesting. in 1630 and 1631, Rutherford started to catch flack for his views and his activities. One problem parishioner complained about him, and he was to be tried by the Court of High Commission. But the wind and the waves refused to give passage to the Bishop of St. Andrews, who was supposed to sit in judgment, so nothing happened. But in 1634, Thomas Sidsurf replaced Lamb as the Bishop of Galloway. Galloway is the county that Amleth is in. Sidsurf was an activist prelate and started immediately to root out the nonconformists. And a treatise that Rutherford had written defending conventicles actually found itself all the way up to the king, presumably passed there by the bishop. Sidsurf was part of Charles's plans to continue, to conform the Scottish churches. So, in 1636, Rutherford was summoned before a court of high commission. He was removed from Amleth in order to be confined in Aberdeen. And Aberdeen had long been a stronghold of, first Catholic and then later Episcopalian thinking. It was hoped there that he might be influenced by the Aberdeen doctors in a more moderate direction. It turns out later they actually tried to get him to be banished somewhere else because of the influence he was having. He arrived there in September of 1636, and he spent about 18 months there. And that would have taken us right up to the time that the national, about the time of the National Covenant, but also when about the time of the Prayer Book riots. So, in a letter to Lady Boyd, he said, "The Lord has brought me to Aberdeen, where I see God in few. This town has been advised upon purpose for me. It consisteth either of papists or men of Galileo's naughty faith. It is counted wisdom in the most not to countenance a confined minister." So he found people ignoring him on the streets, looking away. "But I find Christ neither strange nor unkind, for I have found many faces smile upon me since I came hither. I am heavy and sad, considering what is betwixt the Lord and my soul, which none seeth but he." So, Galileo, does anybody know who Galileo is? Galileo's naughty faith. Galileo was the proconsul of Achaia and refused to hear the Jews' complaints against Paul, since, as he said, it was a question of words and names in your own law. Okay, this is Acts 18. And then later, just a couple verses down, the Greeks are beating Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and he didn't do anything about that either. He was, you could say he was tolerant, but he was indifferent to religion. And so those are Galileo's naughty faith, those who are indifferent towards religion. He says he did find faces smiling, and as I said, the Aberdeen doctors wanted to have him exiled further north to either Orkney, which are islands off the north coast of Scotland, or Caithness, which is the farthest north part of Scotland. Okay, he filled that time with extensive correspondence, and both to his parishioners in Anwath and to friends, nobles, lairds, burgesses, and ministers all over Scotland, according to Coffey. Rutherford's today widely known for his letters, and this is leads to you'll hear different people quoting Rutherford today. In the light of Rutherford's own reluctance to publish his letters, it is ironic that his posthumous reputation has rested upon them almost entirely, whilst the works he published in his lifetime have suffered almost complete neglect. Rutherford the controversialist was forgotten. Rutherford the evangelical mystic remained. Since the original publication in 1664, the letters have been republished no fewer than 80 times in English in many editions. The publishing history of Rutherford's writings and sermons reveals much about the history of British Protestantism. The ultimate failure of the Puritan Revolution, combined with the success of the Glorious Revolution, to make evangelical Protestantism more otherworldly and pietistic. The evangelical revival of the 18th century under Wesley and Whitfield probably strengthened this tendency and severely undermined cerebral reform scholasticism. The result was that Rutherford was appropriated by a quietist tradition that chose to ignore his polemical works, but found his devotional writings of great value for the inner life of the soul. Arminian evangelicals had no difficulty in extracting the gold of Rutherford's piety and leaving behind the dross of his scholastic predestinarianism. And when I first read this, quote from Coffee, I think what I thought what he meant was that Arminian evangelicals, of course, viewed, you know, the goal of Rutherford's piety, but the other part is sort of dross. I don't see it as dross, of course, but I think Coffee probably does. I think that's I think he's tried to be pretty fair about it, but I think that's probably part of his views. Okay, we're running low on time, believe it or not. I was going to read a letter that he wrote to John Stuart, Provost of I. Yeah, I think we have time to read at least some of this to give you a feel for one of his letters. This seems like sort of what I would call maybe a middle of the road letter. It gives you a flavor for it. It's not, some of his letters today seem quite over the top in the sort of imagery and so on that he uses. They just seem very foreign to us, but this is sort of a intermediate one. This is to the Provost of I, who was he was lavishly generous in support of those suffering persecution for conscience' sake, and later, owing to the ravages of plague, he lost much of his money. And he, along with Robert Blair, tried to emigrate to America, and they got, turned back by the weather. But anyways, that doesn't come up till the next letter. So, much honored and dearest in Christ, grace, mercy, and peace from God our Father and from our Lord Jesus Christ be upon you. I expected the comfort of a letter to a prisoner from you. See now. I am here, sir, putting off a part of my inch of time, and when I awake first in the morning, which is always with great heaviness and sadness, this question is brought to my mind. Am I serving God or not? Not that I doubt of the truth of this honorable cause wherein I am engaged. I dare venture to eternity and before my judge that I now suffer for the truth, because that I cannot endure that my master, who is a freeborn king, should pay tribute to any of the shields or potsherds of the earth. Oh, that I could hold the crown upon my princely king's head with my sinful arm, howbeit it should be struck from me in that service from the shoulder blade. But my closed mouth, my dumb Sabbath, dumb as in silent, the memory of my communion with Christ in many fair, fair days in Anwath, whereas now my master getteth no service of my tongue, as then, has almost broken my faith in two halves. Yet in my deepest apprehensions of his anger, I see through a cloud that I am wrong. And beside, he has visited my soul and watered it with his comforts. The great men, my friends that did for me, are dried up like winter brooks of water. All say, no dealing for that man. His best will be to be gone out of the kingdom. So I see they tire of me. But believe me, I am most godly content that Christ breaketh all my idols in pieces. It has put a new edge upon my blunted love to Christ. I see that he is jealous of my love and will have all to himself. In a word, these six things are my burden. 1. I am not in the vineyard as others are. It may be because Christ thinketh me a withered tree, not worth its room, but God forbid. 2. Woe is coming upon my harlot mother, this apostate Kirk. The time is coming when we shall wish for dove's wings to flee and hide us. Oh, for the desolation of this land. 3. I see my dear master Christ going his lone, as it were, mourning in sackcloth. His fainting friends fear that King Jesus shall lose the field, but he must carry the day. 4. My guiltiness and the sins of youth are coming up against me, and they would come into the plea in my sufferings as deserving causes in God's justice. But I pray God, for Christ's sake, that he may never give them that room. 5. Woe is me that I cannot get my royal, dreadful, mighty, and glorious Prince of the Kings of the Earth set on high. Sir, you may help me and pity me in this, and bow your knee, and bless his name, and desire others to do it, that he has been pleased in my sufferings to make atheists, papists, and enemies about me say, it is like that God is with this prisoner. Yet hell and the powers of hell I care not be let loose against me to do their worst, so being that Christ and my Father and his Father be magnified in my sufferings. Christ's love has pained me, for howbeit his presence has shamed me and drowned me in debt, yet he often goes away when my love to him is burning. He seemeth to look like a proud wooer who will not look upon a poor match that is dying of love. I will not say he is lordly, but I know he is wise in hiding himself from a child and a fool, who maketh an idol and a god of one's of one of Christ's kisses, which is idolatry. I fear that I adore his comforts more than himself, and that I love the apples of life better than the tree of life. Sir, write to me, commend me to your wife, mercy be her portion. Grace be with you, yours and his dearest Lord Jesus. So, that's one of his letters, and I think you can see how it would fairly appeal to pietists. You know, it's a very pious letter. It's when Coffee called Rutherford an evangelical mystic. I think if you see, there's a lot of imagery, and there's some in this letter and more in other letters. And so in a lot of the letters that, you know, if you have a shorter collection of letters, I think they tend to favor the more pietistic letters, typically. I tried to find some of the other letters that Coffee quoted that I thought were more, you know, theologically oriented, and they weren't in the collection that I downloaded on the internet. But yeah.
Interruption for the bookkeeper. What do you have? Is there a complete works out there, or
I'm not there? Well, there's been one published of all the letters that, you know, as complete as it can be, and I think Coffee said,
well, complete works in the sense of all the letters, what, or of all
no letters. Well, I'm only talking about letters. Yeah. There's this issue or edition edited by Bonar in 1865. Is that still in print?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's supposedly the most complete. Yeah. Yeah. For the record, Dave's holding his fingers about 2 inches apart. So. Okay. So some of his letters are more to the point. Coffee quotes one that was written to Rutherford's parishioners at Anwath. He says, "Hate and keep yourselves from idols. Forbear in any case to hear the reading of the new fatherless service book, full of gross heresies, popish and superstitious errors, without any warrant of Christ, tending to the overthrow of preaching. You owe no obedience to the bastard canons. They are unlawful, blasphemous, and superstitious. All the ceremonies that lie in Antichrist's foul womb, the wares of that great mother of fornications, the Kirk of Rome, are to be refused." So, some of his letters were a little more direct and to the point. let's see. Okay, Rutherford left Aberdeen shortly after the National Covenant was signed in February 1638, and at the Glasgow General Assembly in November 1638, Rutherford was exonerated from all the censures that he'd been under, and he also acted as a witness against Thomas Sidsurf, the bishop who'd exiled him to Aberdeen, and Sidsurf was deposed. He was now a central figure in the Church of Scotland. He was appointed to a committee which was to investigate the corruptions and errors of the books of canons, service and ordination, and to investigate the High Commission. And he also was spending time meeting with the Alexander Henderson and Blair, etc., who were, I guess you could say, you know, in the forefront of pushing the Reformation forward. Let's see, after the Glasgow Assembly, he returned to Anwath, but he was now too well known, too highly valued to be sort of remain unnoticed in a rural parish. So he was called to be a minister in Edinburgh, and then he was also called to be a professor at St. Andrews, and the General Assembly of 1639 appointed him to that over the protest of both Rutherford's parishioners and Rutherford. Okay, so he went off to St. Andrews. I think we'll stop there. I would like to bring this, I guess, well, possibly next week or the week after, forward at least to, say, 1650, and then I haven't really decided how we'll proceed from there. We may stop on Rutherford at that point and then pick back up in our history. Well, after, I'd like to cover some other people, too, I think. So, are there any questions?
What year did he go to Anwath? What year was the church going?
It was about the same time. I think he went in 1627, I think. Yeah, he went in 1627. In fact, they don't know the exact date isn't known. There's some message or some letter he wrote sometime like the middle of the year or something, but it doesn't sound like it sounds like he knew people and so on, like he hadn't just arrived, so that presumably he went earlier in the year.
So did they build the church for him?
Well, I don't know. He's got that plaque over the door there. But the it says it was built in 1627, according to the inscription over the entryway. Maybe he built the church, but in addition to all those other things he was doing, maybe he built the church. A real example. Other questions? Okay, well, we'll stop there then.